Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim R., and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting on NavaZoom, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our NavaZoom room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear tonight's speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Brad E. is familiar with most of us here. He is loved and respected by many, especially myself, because I know how much he has meant in my sobriety. He, you know, things happen in life, and he always perseveres, and he faces each day, and has stayed sober now over 39 years. So let's hope old Brad makes it 40 next summer.
Thanks, Tim. I appreciate that. I'm Brad, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Brad.
Tim, you've meant your service has meant a lot to me, because I remember the last time you were involved recording anything I spoke. It was at Bill's memorial, and I remember that very well, and appreciate that.
Amen. Great man.
This program is a program of miracles, and I'm going to start out with something that I was going to share in the last meeting, but it wasn't appropriate to the subject material. I mentioned Saturday night that I spent 2.5 hours talking to a cousin that I haven't spoken to in 50 years over an aunt possibly not dying or possibly dying. And I found out just at the end of the meeting last night that as I was sharing in the meeting last night, she passed. Wow. As I was sharing. Where in the world does that happen? The miracle of it is I felt something. I knew something somewhere. It was something. And if there's any place to be, if something like that happens, what a place to be. So I was going to share that earlier, but it's like, wow. You know, I keep getting more and more and more amazed as to the miracles of things that happen in the program. And of course, I think every day that I wake up and have an opportunity to stay sober is another miracle. Because when I got here, I was in bad shape. Very, very bad shape. And I'm going to try to tell my story a little bit differently tonight in the sense that I'm going to run down what happened to me before I started drinking, which is why I drank so heavily. Because I only drank for 5 years. And I've had people here in Covington when I moved ask, how in the world could you get that bad in 5 years? So I'm going to try to explain it in a way that maybe it makes sense to some of you. And if it doesn't, then afterwards, if you want to contact me, contact me and I'll talk to you about it. But you see, my dad is retired Army. My first memories are in Okinawa, Japan. I went to kindergarten in Okinawa. And the first three memories that I have in Okinawa are fear, water, fear, water, fear, water. Duh. And I joined the Navy later. But it was just fear, fear, fear. And part of the also that one of the things that hit me there is the memory of my mother throwing my dad's bags out the front door, telling him where he could go. And the yelling and arguing and screaming involved with that on both sides. So it's all this fear. Well, then we moved back to the United States. When we moved back to the United States, course, since I was born in Fort Benning, we go to Fort Benning. I'm beginning to learn how to read. And, of course, in those days, you didn't have a lot of money. And I'm reading the signs when the bus stops. And I'm seeing something that just doesn't make sense to me. And I look at my mom going, I don't understand as I'm watching these people walk to the back of the bus. Because I'm also reading these signs that say colored only. And my mother puts her mouth, her hand across my mouth and does, shh, don't say anything. That's what they do here. And what I did with that is I started to internalize everything that bothered me. Don't say anything. Keep your mouth shut. So I just started internalizing and internalizing and would never express from that point on. I took that literally for everything, not just that situation. But it confused me because in Okinawa, we're on a military reservation. Guess what? We're around people. It didn't matter. So it really confused me. What was this about? And of course, I was young enough. I didn't investigate or anything, but it made a distinct importance in my life a little bit later on. Then there were some events that started confusing me, not just with the theater. So I remember standing in front of this little black and white TV. It was old because it was a big one. It was 13 inches. And I'm watching this thing and I see this guy talking on it and I hear the word death in my mom's screech. It's the only time period I've ever heard my mom screech. I happen to be watching Walter Cronkite announcing JFK's death. I just hear the screech here. And then, of course, other things that are confusing me at the time, because there's other deaths going on, because our society was changing, just added more and more fear. Because after that, what happens? Malcolm, then MLK, then Robert Kennedy. So all this time and all this social stuff going on TV that was just, is all fear of fear. Now, at the same time period, I'm on a military reservation. I'm watching all these guys come back without any arms, without legs. I see the families crying, people dying, mourning their families. I'm 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old in these times. I'm watching the body counts on the news, questioning whether or not my father is alive or dead every night. I'm also going to school being bullied because of the news and all this protest and everything else. I was the son of a baby killer. Needless to say, I'm internalizing everything. I have nobody to speak to. My father did something to me when he was leaving to go to Vietnam that he didn't realize either how I would take it. And that's where a little bit later, all this will help to change because perspective. As he was on the tarmac and giving us all a hug to say goodbye, he tells me I'm the man of the house. And I took it literally. I now have the responsibility of the family on my shoulders. And I'm watching all this stuff on the news and everything else, and there's nothing I can do about any of it because I'm confused and I'm just scared. Because I'm watching all this death around me, all these riots around me, all of this confusion. Well, needless to say, it didn't take long after my father came back from Vietnam for life to really make a large change. And what happened there, which really changed my life greatly, is he wanted to know if it was okay that we moved to Atlanta because they were about to restation him. And he wanted to know if it was okay if we moved outside, right outside of West Gate of Fort McPherson, which is Campbellton Road. And we're like, sure, why not? And we do just that. And of course, I got bullied again very severely. I was pushed on the ground almost every day walking home from school, beat up at least once a week. And the reason for it, my skin was the wrong color. And that just confused me. Why? I didn't understand. You know, No wonder I didn't fit in. And with me internalizing everything, I was in so much pain. By the time I took my first drink, I was happy to have a drink to get rid of all the pain because I didn't know what to do with any of this. You know, when I got to high school, once again, I didn't fit in. Why? They're wearing ragged out jeans and t-shirts. I'm wearing double knit and polyester. I didn't fit in. Nor did I care at that point. I had gotten to a point where I just plain did not care. Well, I ended up joining the Navy, and that's where my drinking career started. My dad happened to call me a liar one day, only time period he ever hit me, and gave me the choice of staying in his home, living with his rules, or leave. I left. Now, here's what happens when I drink, and I'm not going to get involved with how I drank, just events that happened to me, which is a good reason why I don't need to be drinking and why I need to be in this program. The very first night I left my parents' home, I've got a 38 stuck right here. The very first night. I leave from there, and I start living in cardboard boxes. Every time it rained, I had to change apartments. I used to have this joke that I had to change from Maytag to Frigidaire to Whirlpool. And unfortunately, it's the truth. It's not a joke. Yet I lived that way. Then I ended up to get out of that. I'm not going home and live on my dad's rules. I joined the Navy. Now, the Navy was interesting to me because I did it to piss off my father. He wanted to know why, since I had this fear of water, I wanted to join the Navy, and I told him it's because I wasn't going to crawl around in any mud. He was Army, and I was not going to be what was called a mud puppy. Well, he tried to convince me not to join because of my problem with authority, and 3 years later, he was absolutely right, because those who know anything about the military will understand this. I made E1 three times, E2 three times, and E3 three times in 3 years. If they said something that I didn't like or told me to do something I didn't like, I left and I came back when I wanted to. Now, I ended up going up to Iowa to see my grandparents in the Christmas of 75. And when I did this, not only I told you earlier about the gun, but we're talking about within 4 months after that gun. I was sitting in my grandmother's basement playing a stupid game. And the result of that stupid game is I shot somebody point blank range, put a line across his chest and almost killed him. So guess what? Here it is. I was drunk. Then, of course, I get after that, I go back to San Diego, and I'm going to share something I've never shared before, and the reason for it is because I've talked to some people recently that's needed to hear, and I had swore that there were certain things on my fifth step that I would never discuss, and this happens to be one of them. After I return back to San Diego and get out of all that, and we're heading back to Atlanta, I'm AWOL again. I find and catch a ride to Chattanooga, Tennessee, thank goodness, but from Chattanooga, I'm going to hitchhike down here to Atlanta. Now, I'm drunk and drinking, and not just drunk and drinking, there's other substances involved as well, powerful substances. On the hitchhiking back down, the guy that picked me up told me, he says, hey, instead of sleeping on the streets tonight since it's dark, I'll let you stay at my place. Oh, fine, hey, what a nice fellow. Get to his place, he mixes me a drink, I drink it, I come to being raped. So here it is, what did I do? All of that internal, all of that hesitation, all of that stuffing, and not only this time was it fear, but now it's terror. Now it's terror. And now it takes much more for me to drown that. Much, much more. Now, the next event, just to go through some quick events before I get to the program, I got in trouble with the law because once again, I didn't agree with something that the officers in the Navy told me to do. So I ended up getting arrested by the Secret Service. Didn't particularly care to get in too much trouble, so I was the coward and told on everything I knew. When I got back to Boston, Massachusetts, I told the guy that I got the stuff from that, hey, I did this. Within a few weeks, I'm walking past a room, and if you ever walk past a room and you get past it and you have this sinking feeling something's not right, you back up and look. Well, that's what I did. And then I ran in there to pick him up and hold him and scream for help because he had hung himself. Now he didn't die. I don't know how long I held on to him. What I do know is I was almost at my end of not being able to hold on to him anymore when people came in. And within a few months after that, he decided since the sheet that he was hanging himself with wasn't good enough, 30-06 would. Now, guess who blamed himself for it? Shame, guilt, blame. Now there was no way I could consume enough to get rid of the pain. It got bad enough to where I blacked out in Amsterdam, Netherlands, and came to about 4.5 months later in Boston, Massachusetts. For a very, very long time of my military, matter of fact, it took 2 years sober. I had to ask a buddy of mine who was in the Navy to come down and spend a weekend with me so that he could help put these events that I knew in sequence. Because I knew this happened, I knew this happened, I knew this happened, but I didn't know in what sequence they went in. No clue. Well, this is why. So at 22 years old, and mind you, this is all happening before I turned 20. I hadn't been drinking 3 years. Any reason, any wonder why I got to the program at 22 years old at the point of desperation of life or death? Not for me. Now, if you've ever watched Laugh-In, this might, there was one funny part of all this, and the funny part of it is how I ended up finding out about NAVA was because my first wife, who took me off of the streets, by the way, I used to live on the stalls at the farmer's market, and she took me off of the stalls on the farmer's market, poor thing. I keep shaking my head. I mean, I should have known that there was a problem. I mean, her brother asked me what street corner she picked me up off of. she really should have known that she was in trouble because I remember one night sitting there with my mother telling her I'd divorce his ass over that shit in front of me. So I was in pretty bad shape. But if you've ever watched Laugh-In, there was one part of it where, I forget the guy's name, but he's on his tricycle, and he pedals his tricycle, and he tips over. Well, that was a daily routine with me and my motorcycle, except I'd pull up to a stoplight, forget to put my feet down, and just bloop. Well, there used to be this place in front of Claremont Lodge, if you remember Claremont Lodge. I was living there at the time, and it was called September Days, and there was this restaurant she was working at in front, and I used to pull up the restaurant because I was going to this place called Northeast Plaza to sell my drugs. I'd actually passed this place called Dabba, and I thought it was some kind of, you know, Elks Lodge or something like this, and they'd pull up, and I'd fall like this, and she started getting talked to by these people that went to this place called NAMA. About maybe I have a drinking problem. Well, I had no clue of all this. I mean, I'm out of it. One night she decides to inform me, no, not inform me that I'm an alcoholic. Now, mind you, you don't tell me much and you don't accuse me of much because if you do that, I'm going to bow up and I'm going to, and that's exactly what I did. Just what do you think you're talking about this? At a fight ensued over nothing more than I had been accused of something. Now, I don't know what an alcoholic is. That's neither here nor there. There was something that I had a difficult time with in those days, and it's a cry and mourn. And I had a temper. I would lose my temper. And she started crying and us going back and forth with me bowing up. And I decided for the first time in my life to leave. But as I'm walking out the door, she begged me to stay. And unbeknownst to me, I did. And lo and behold, I blew up. I damaged at least 5 walls, some very expensive equipment that I owned. I just lost it. And she actually, I tried to get her to quit crying, and I figured the way to do that was to tell her if she didn't quit crying, I'd throw the bottle in the TV set. You know, I knew how to do that. She didn't quit crying, and that's exactly what I did. I threw the bottle into the TV set. She left after then. I didn't have to deal with a crying woman. But that was a good throw. The bottle didn't break. The TV did, but not the bottle. And I decided to pour a drink. And it was straight up. Now, I paced the floor with this drink. What's an alcoholic? I have no idea. None whatsoever. But my head would not let that go. I got accused of being an alcoholic. What's an alcoholic? Back and forth and back and forth. I built it into an emergency that I had to know what an alcoholic was. So I did the only thing I knew to do in an emergency. I picked up the phone and I dialed 911 to ask. That's a little insane because I'm also a drug dealer and I've got a house full of drugs. Now, they were kind enough. Now, first of all, back in those days, they didn't have caller ID. But they were kind enough to take my telephone number, my first name, they didn't want my last name, and said that they'd have somebody call back. And the people that called back were from United Way. And I don't know how long it took, but I ended up finishing the drink, asking, am I an alcoholic? And their response was, I don't know, but I know where you can find out. And that place's name was NAVA. And I assured them that the next morning, that's what I would be. I would be at NAVA, and I was. And I walked into this meeting. And if you know NAVA, you walk into the doors, and you've got the curtains right there, the sliding curtains right there. And I sat right there because I wanted to be real close to leaving. And, of course, I sit there, and I'm looking at all these old people. And I remember Sarah telling her story for Sarah, because Sarah was telling her, having her first birthday, Sarah W. That's all I remember of the meeting. I went to leave at the end of the meeting, but I couldn't because it was a birthday meeting, and the table was there with all the cake, and I'm trying to disappear. And I can't get through these people and disappear, so I just decided to sit there and shrink. Now, I'm still really hungover, and I had to smell. Some guy hands me a big book with his name, his telephone number, and a date. One of the ladies come up and handed me a piece of cake and told me to keep coming back, and I watched all these people smiling, laughing. They genuinely cared about each other. I could see that. And for the first time, I wanted something other than where I was. Now, I didn't know if I had a drinking problem or not. I just did what I told somebody I would do the night before. I don't even know why I did it. Well, I ended up leaving, and I had somebody ask me to keep coming back. Well, I did. I came back. And what I wanted was I wanted more of that smiling and that togetherness. I had no idea if I wanted sobriety. I didn't know if I was an alcoholic, which meant that I ended up drinking again. Because I didn't work steps. I didn't do nothing. I just shared and sat and watched the smiles and wanting more and more and more of the smiles. Now, when I drank again, I'm a pretty good drunk. I mean, they had Coors beer. And in those days, you couldn't get Coors in Atlanta or in Georgia. but we didn't have any ice. I told them that I would be more than willing to cool it down if they give me a six pack. They looked at me and laughed, says, okay, says, we don't think you can cool it down. There's no ice around here. So they gave me a six pack and I grabbed a fire extinguisher and a cooler. I cooled that to bring it down. I had me some cold beer to drink. Then I promised myself that I would have no more. And I stood outside a liquor store not knowing how I went in with a bottle of liquor. And of course, I'm going to get drunk. I drank it. That happened 3 days in a row. Each day, I promised myself I would not do it. And that's exactly what I did each day. I knew on the third day, on the fourth day, when I really, 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 really wanted that drink, that I could not trust myself. I finally reached out for help. And I called a guy by the name of Jason. Jason T. Mind you, Jason asked me if I could get to the meeting that night without a drink. And that night happened to be a Thursday night. And the meeting he's talking about was the old Thursday night men's group. And that was a tough, tough group. We're talking about judges being in it. It's a really, really tough, strong sobriety. And I told this man that he did not understand how bad I wanted a drink. Now, I'm going to share this with you, and it's part of his story to understand just how my head was, because I knew this information. This is a man whose bottom was so low, he used to strain his vomit in the morning to make sure that he did not go into the DTs. And I'm telling this man he did not understand how bad I wanted a drink. He finally got me to where he asked me if I could go a minute, because he truly did understand. And he stepped it down and stepped it down. And I actually looked at my watch, and I watched my watch for a full minute. After that minute, I asked him again. So, okay, I did that. Now what? Do it again. So I did. I watched my watch again. Do it again. Now, I want you guys to know I'm really bright. I really catch on quick. So I asked him, now what again? So I ended up being able to get through that day 1 to 5, sometimes 10 minutes at a time for hours to get to that meeting. Now, I got to the meeting. There was a guy by the name of Bob Logan that was there. And Bob had a tendency to sit there and read his big book before the meeting. I walked up to Bob, and Bob, nobody knew that I had drank except for Lois. Jason's wife knew, because she was the Al-Anon sponsor to my wife at the time. And because Jason didn't know. I told Bob, hey, Bob, I slipped. Because in those days, you didn't use the word relapse. I slipped. He finished his paragraph. He looked up at me and said, you jumped. And went right back to his big book. I didn't take too kindly to that. Now, I didn't say anything, but I internalized, you asshole. I went through the meeting. The next day, because I decided to quit the job, I couldn't trust myself on the job. At that time period, I was so afraid for my life, because I now know I'm an alcoholic. And at 22, if I'm this bad, if I continue, I'm dead. I had gotten to that point of desperation. There was a man at the 11 o'clock meeting that I had a tremendous amount of respect for. His name was Dal. And I walked up to Dal, sitting up against the road, because the road, that wall, the row of chairs by the wall was the old timers room. And by the way, Dal knew Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. He used to argue God with him. He was one of the first Oakland A's. I went up to Dal and said, Dal, I slipped. And Dal looked at me and says, slipped is between shit and syphilis in the dictionary and a woman's undergarment. You jumped. And I looked at him. I shut my mouth. I said that A word again, internally, and I walked away. And the next day, it occurred to me that these two people just told me the truth. That rather than let me play the poor, pitiful me, see what happened and all this as this young kid could do and manipulate, they didn't let me do that. They made me own it. I'm responsible for my recovery once I don't have a drink. Those two men saved my life. In many ways, they saved my life. And matter of fact, the last time I saw Dal was, Dal and I got close enough that we could communicate without speaking. And the last time I saw him was a very, very special event. I was given tickets, to a concert. I happened to be working for this, I ended up having one of the miracles of the program, and I ended up creating the City of Norcross's computer department back in the 80s. And during that time period, the city had gotten some tickets, and nobody could go, and I was asked if I wanted to go, and I decided I needed a break. I'd been working 90 hours a week, so I grabbed the tickets, called the wife, and said, "Hey, you want to go to the concert down at Chastain?" "Who?" I don't know who this lady is, but supposedly she's pretty good. We get there, they're really nice seats. I see Dal walk in with Linda Green. And of course him and I wave and smile and everything else. Then the concert starts, and when this lady opens her mouth, I was just amazed. It was Sarah Vaughan. And Dal and I are looking at each other, and we could just, the love between the two of us, it was there. That kind of connection, and there's the key word to me, is connection that him and I had gained. Now, I'm not going to get into a bunch of other stuff simply because I want to get to some of the other miracles that I've had happen in the program. So I'm not going to go through the steps like I normally would. We know how to live steps if we're going to practice this program. But what does that give us? You know, to me, it gives us a lot of miracles. And one of the miracles that happens is being able to own what we do. And I say that in this sense. There's a joke going around about how do you become an old timer? Well, you don't drink and you don't die. Well, you see, that's half the truth. In my case, that's half the truth. See, you have to survive the wreckage of your sobriety. And that's what happened with me. The miracle of surviving the wreckage of my sobriety. And I say that in this sense. I was able to gain a career because working at a gas station wasn't enough. I was able to, and this is kind of funny, and I'm going to say it this way. I had men in the program that I could look up to that I really, really respected. One of them, you know him by the plaque on the podium, his name's Stan Parks. Mickey B., who still serves there, I worked for him for 2 years. He gave me my first job. There were several judges there that were DeKalb County judges. Matter of fact, it was kind of, there used to be a judge, and there was a time period in the Thursday night men's group, he would be sitting there along with his brother, who was the professional bank robber. And you see the two of them together along with all of us. There was a man that used to drive in the Nava in his Rolls Royce in those days. And he walks in and you could tell the amount of money this man has. But when he sits down and he starts to talk to you, guess what? No different than the rest of us drunks. That was a gift in my sobrieties to see the equality of everybody in this program, regardless of how much money, where you came from, or what you look like. None of that mattered. But I also had this thing about, I'm a 22-year-old young guy, and I was asked to do something called DJ Dances at NAVA. So I'm learning to get out of this shell of this person that had pulled everything inward to start letting it out some. And I got to where I'd started dancing at NAVA, and I wouldn't get off the floor until it ended. And at the same time period, I'm starting to have connections with my family once again. And there was there was these three women at NAVA that I used to look at and just admire and respect and want to get to know them better. And it's nothing more than, hey, you know, they were models of people that I wanted to be around. I had the guys, but the women was funny. One of their names was Belinda Green. She was a phenomenal lady, beautiful. Then there was another lady who ended up becoming my mother-in-law, Barbara Keith. Very, very beautiful lady. And there's another lady who's sitting right over there. Her name's Isla. And these people I watched as they carried themselves with grace and elegance. It's something I didn't know. And that helped lift me even higher to want to do better. Well, I ended up doing better. I ended up going to school at DePry. I was so scared of taking their entrance exam that I waited to the very last day. I'm supposed to take a logics test. Me? At this time period, I have an eighth grade reading skill and an eighth grade language skill. And I'm going to go to DePry. I actually made it. Now, I did not graduate. I got too sick. I was working full time, et cetera, but I did do that. I ended up graduating from another school. But in the process of this, I gained a career. Wow. Yeah, I did what it took. I ended up traveling the country, installing fund accounting software throughout the country that I had developed, which was really a beautiful thing to be able to go to meetings in Montana, Wisconsin, California, Utah. Wow. And of course, there were some places that I got to where there just was not a meeting. Yeah. Sorry, but there's some towns in northern Montana that's got less than 600 people. If you're going to have a meeting, you go talk to the cows. And there were a few times that I did just that. And it was okay. But part of the miracles to me, and part of getting through the wreckage of our sobriety is divorces. I've had three divorces and three marriages. And one of the things with that, and the reason I mentioned that, is one of the things that was very important for me to do, because I watched around these AA clubs of how people would end up with these devastating things, and people would take sides, this, that, and the other thing. I haven't done that. I decided I did not want to play that game. I've kept it to myself and not bowed mouth another human being. I still do that, not just with the ex-wives, but with other people. This program gave me that. I watched people do that. Another issue, because this is something that became very important to me, is I watched people with something called integrity. They made a mistake, they owned up to it, and they take the consequences of it. And I'll briefly mention this. Just before the ex-wife informed me that I was an alcoholic, my brother tried to pay me in a drug deal with a check. And when I told him I wouldn't accept the check and tore it up, he swung at me. And the result of swinging at me is I beat him so badly that I physically couldn't swing anymore. And my mother said the next day she couldn't recognize who he was. All I remember is I started swinging. I snapped. I have no memory. And I say no memory. I had no choice. I had no way of stopping myself. I watched it all, but I lost it. I had another occasion like that happened to me about 12 years sober. And the end result of it is I went to prison. And I went to prison because I wanted to own up to my responsibility of my wrong and not recreate. Let's face it. My natural instincts were to try to run and get away with it, and the odds are I probably could have, but that's not the point. The point is, do I have the integrity to know that if I take and accept this responsibility that I can still live sober? If I get out of it and manipulate that, then I'm being dishonest in my core, and if I'm going to be dishonest at my core, I will drink. And every person I've seen get that way and beat a charge, dishonest at their core, has drank. I didn't want to do that. the result is I'm very, very, very thankful that I didn't do that, because I'm a far better man today and a far better human being today. I have much more of an understanding of things today than I ever did. Because the interesting thing is, one of the things I didn't realize, and here's a really big gift of it, is my behavior is like a pyramid. It's like a multi-level marketing scheme. If I put out an act of kindness, guess what happens? It multiplies. When I hurt somebody, guess what happens? It multiplies. It took that experience to realize the devastation of how something can multiply. Now, the end result of all that was a relationship that I lost with my father, a relationship that was so tarnished with my mother that it was very difficult to repair. I went from, you know, the turd that was on the stalls at the farmer's market to the golden boy back to the turd. But it was okay. Because I did what I did, my mother and I ended up having a relationship to where I actually was holding her hand a few moments before she passed. And it was a relationship to where we could say and discuss anything at all, which was beautiful. I developed that kind of relationship with two other people in the program. And one of them I still talk to every day. One of them's name is Bill Nolan. You see, I at a few months in needed more than just Jason. Jason helped me stay sober with simplicity. I needed somebody that would help me get inside that would not judge my internals. Because my internals were ugly. I had all that junk that I'd been stuffing for so long. And I asked Jason if it was okay if I had a second sponsor. And Jason was like, as long as you don't play one against the other, the answer is yes. As soon as you start playing one against the other, then you will reap the benefits of that and you won't like it. Well, at the time period when Bill spoke in meetings, you have to understand, this man has an IQ of like 185. I mean, he's just really, really smart. But he could take his language down to where you were. He was like God when he spoke. He became my sponsor. Then from that, we became co-sponsors and friends to the point of being my brother. The last 2.5 years of his life, I took him to meetings because he couldn't drive. I've actually had people tell me that I was not obligated to do it, and I kept trying to tell them, you don't understand, this isn't out of obligation, this is out of love. This is because I care for who he is. Now, those who have seen me outside of meetings, I wear a hat when I don't have the long hair, because I haven't had a haircut in, oh my God, this is the longest my hair's ever been in my life. But I wear a hat. And Bill used to talk about what changed his life in the program, and the miracle of the program was when he started reading a big book to help another human being. And when he was in DeKalb County Hospital and he was dying, he asked me if I would do him a favor, and I said yes. And he said, I want your hat to go with me. And of course, I knew immediately what that meant. Here's a man that him and I grew close enough together that he wanted to take a part of me with him when he passed. And of course, I said yes, and yes, that did indeed happen. His daughter made sure that happened. But it occurred to me right into that time period, because, you know, like I said earlier, with the 1 minute at a time, and I had to ask and ask, I'm really slow, that part of what helped him and I gain the relationship that we had was he saved my life. I mean, and I looked at him and he saved my life. He let me get inside here and didn't judge it. What I didn't realize is he thought I was the one that saved his life, because I'm the one that he read the big book for differently to try to help somebody, to where all of a sudden the big book made sense that it fit him. He was 9 months sober when I asked him to sponsor me. When he passed, we had been together as friends for 35 years. That is a miracle of this program. Because when I came in, nobody wanted anything to do with me. And I can't blame them. I didn't want anything to do with me. I'm going to try to end it with one other one. I had another lady that did that. Her name's Marion. I used to live with Marion. She's a little short girl. I got friends with her family to where her entire family would reach out to me to see how she was doing and et cetera. That's not the way this program was when I got here. I have a tough time with my story because you can imagine I've been sober 39 years. I mean, that's 17 years longer than the age that I was when I came into the program. It's kind of weird. And really, it's kind of weird. So to tell the story the way I would like to, with all the different things that I could discuss and all of this, it gets difficult. But one of the miracles of the program that I really value, very highly value, and it took a long time for me to express it in a way that I felt comfortable with, is each and every one of you, whether I know you or not. See, my experience has said I use the most difficult four-letter word in my vocabulary, and I use that word honestly and with integrity, that you're there. There's nothing more valuable to me and a bigger, larger gift and miracle to me than that. And that word, by the way, is help. Thanks. Thanks for my sobriety.
Wow.
Thank you, Brad.
Thank you, Brad.
Thanks, Brad. Love you.
Amazing, Brad. Thanks. Thank you, Brad.
I can relate to a lot of that, Brad. The whole Navy, the whole spoof on that end.
I know you can. Hurrah.
I wasn't going to be a Marine like my dad either, okay?
You know, you don't want to be
Brad, you talked about Bill Nolan and how much he meant in your life, and you had the opportunity to share that in his memorial service. And it may sound morbid to some that we record some of these memorial services, but they are truly a celebration of somebody's life. They're just beautiful. And those recordings that we've done so far in the last few years are on aabluechipspeakers.org. They have a special page that says Other Priceless Audios. And so you have M, you've got just a whole host of people, Bob Meadows, Bill Roop, Jim Harp. Some of these names, you know, they just live on, and they're there, you know, maybe a little melancholy, just want to listen to one of those. It's a very fast hour. There's so much there. And celebrating somebody's life and how much they meant to others in recovery. So thanks for reminding me of that, Brad.
Brad, so very much. I was really relating to that. Don't talk about it. Shut up. Don't talk about it. I was totally with you.
Hit a new low. Came to in somewhere strange to me. As I rode from town to town, can't put the bottle down. Right now feels like it's killing me. Life out here gets so depressing. Something to to take the edge, you see.